morning. Well, it all started with kind of a weird crush. After watching the movie Taxi Driver, John Hinckley Jr. developed this crush on a young, brand new teenage actress named Jodie Foster, right? And he just became obsessed with her. He loved her. And he started writing her letters, and he started calling her on the phone, and even a couple times got to talk to her. He started leaving gifts at her door. How creepy is that, right? He would hang around her sorority to kind of see if he could hear conversations with her. But it seemed like no matter what he did, he wasn't able to get the reaction from her that he wanted. He wanted her to see how much he loved her, and she would fall in love with him too. But no matter what he did, it wasn't enough. All his efforts seemed to be unsuccessful. So finally he decided, I'm going to have to do something that I need to do something historic. I need to do something that's so historic that she will be impressed at how much I love her. She will be in love with me. She will respect what I've been trying to do. And so on March 30th, 1981, he decided he was going to assassinate the President of the United States. Well, that'll win a girl's heart, right? That'll do it. Now, he had no personal animosity against President Reagan. He just happened to be the president at the time. He'd been president for 70 days. And on this day, he was giving a speech at the Hilton Hotel in Washington, D.C., and Hinckley opened the paper that morning and read about it. And so he decided, well, that's the place for me to be today. So as President Reagan was leaving the hotel, and he was walking out, and he was waving to supporters, and all of a sudden, Hinckley was able to get within about 15 feet of the president. He pulls out his gun, and he starts shooting. And in 1.7 seconds, he let off 6 rounds. One hit the press secretary in the head, and he was wounded, disabled for the rest of his life. A second shot hit a Secret Service man who immediately got between Hinckley and the president, and he was shot. Now, all these people survived, fortunately. A third person that was hit was a Washington, D.C. police officer, and he went down. Well, immediately after the first shot rang out, the Secret Service agent with Reagan grabbed Reagan, shoved him into his limo, right? The door was open. He starts pushing him in here. But this to me is just so incredible that this happened just like this. One of the shots that Hinckley fired hit the ground. The bullet was flattened. It ricocheted up off the ground. It hit the side of this limo, and then it kind of spun right between the 2-inch crevice where the door, you know, when you open a car door, it creates kind of a little crevice on the inside there. And that bullet just went right between that little 2-inch crevice. And as Reagan was getting pushed into the car, that bullet came in, hit him right here in the side, hit a rib, and then kind of tumbled down to about within an inch of his heart. Isn't that amazing? I mean, just through that little, just the way that happened. Now, nobody knew the president had been hit. Even the Secret Service agent, when he pushed him into the car, he was worried that maybe Reagan had been hit. So he started, first of all, he's checking out his head. Is he okay? It looks like it. And then he said, as he describes it, he says, I start rubbing my hands over the front of his body to see, is there any blood? They start rubbing his hands around his back. Is there any blood? He didn't find blood anywhere. Because the way this bullet, and because it had been flattened, it just made such a tiny sliver of an incision in Reagan's side. It wasn't like a normal gunshot hole. Isn't that a fun thought on a Sunday morning? So he radioed to everybody else. He said, hey, I think he's okay. But Reagan said, man, my rib really hurts. He goes, I think you must have busted a rib when you pushed me into the vehicle. And all of a sudden, he starts coughing up blood, and more blood, and more blood. And they're like, get him to the hospital immediately. They rush him to the hospital. He goes in, he walks. He says, listen, I want people to see me walking in on my own. He walked in on his own, but as he got in the hospital, his legs start getting rubbery, he says, and they kind of start giving out. They immediately got him on a table, finally figured out he's been shot. And there's a bullet in there. They cut him open. They're in there. Matter of fact, one of the records describes a 31-year-old hospital intern who's in the president's chest, even holding his beating heart, and he's kind of moving it around as they're trying to find, where is this bullet? Can you imagine what that must have been like? Now, you know how the story turns out. Reagan was saved. He turned out to be okay and served out 2 terms of his presidency. But the reason I tell you this story is really more about Reagan's reaction to what happened to him. What would your reaction be? As people talk to you about, man, this guy tried to kill you, this man shot you, what would your reaction be? Watch this clip of Larry King had an interview with Reagan a little bit later, and they were talking about this incident. Check this out.
Did you ever think You might die.
No, although I didn't just leave it to chance. I talked to my friend upstairs about that.
But you never thought that this was the end?
No.
Because some people in that situation, in a trauma situation, think it's over.
No, I found out afterward that a lot of those people there at the hospital thought it could very likely be the end. They said that I was very near going into a state of shock. And I had also lost more than half the blood in my body. And so that, but...
Were you angry?
Well, I didn't know for quite a while until they began to tell me about the young man that had done this and what his problem was, that he was not exactly on a normal basis. And so then I added him to my prayers, that prayers for myself, that, well, if I wanted healing for myself, maybe he should have some healing for himself.
Wow. I remind you of this story because I was so impressed as I was thinking of this message this morning. It's called Benefit of the Doubt. And I heard that interview and I thought, man, that's giving somebody the benefit of the doubt. When you can talk about the man who tried to kill you and go, you know, I thought I'd start praying for him. Is that what you do? That's what I do. I mean, when somebody cuts me off in traffic, I just pray for them, you know, that, Lord, they obviously have issues. And I just, man, when somebody steals your parking spot, isn't it funny how it's always my parking spot? That was my parking spot. It's funny because with our kids, they do that with their seats, right? Have you noticed, like around the table or in the house, you know, they get up and go do something, they come back. That was my spot. And we think that's really immature until we're looking for a parking space. That was my spot. Didn't he know that was my spot? He took my spot. But that's what I do, right? I just pray for them. God, please help that person who took my spot and made me park way back here. Now I have to walk. Please, please help heal them. How do we react toward other people? How do we act toward our spouse, towards our kids, or towards a stranger? Do we give people the benefit of the doubt? I want to invite you to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 10. It's interesting how we tend to look at other people differently than we look at ourselves, right? I mean, we tend to have a distorted view of ourselves. We look at ourselves and we give ourselves every benefit of the doubt. We see ourselves maybe a little more positive than is really there. We cut ourselves slack. But we look at other people and we just distort them. We look at other people and we twist and we just figure they've got the worst intentions and what's wrong with them. Let me share with you, I was reading a book by John Ortberg that I thought was interesting, and he had kind of a neat quote about this. He said, you know, if I yell at my child in the grocery store, it's because they have misbehaved to an extent that would exhaust the patience of Job. If you yell at your child in the grocery store, it's obvious that you're an anger management problem waiting to happen, who never should have been granted a parenting license in the first place. If I get a speeding ticket, it's because the police need to fill their quota so they set a trap when they should be out catching criminals. But if you get a speeding ticket, it shows what a careless driver you are. Isn't that right? Man, we could go on and on. See, if I do it, I can tell you why. Well, I just didn't sleep well last night, and I'm not feeling myself today, and I just... But see, if you do it, well, that's different, right? We give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. What about other people? I want to talk this morning about giving other people the benefit of the doubt. We're going to look at the story in 2 Samuel chapter 10, and this is probably it's kind of an uncommon story, but I think it's interesting. It's about a man, a king, a new king named Hanun, and he just became the king, and he makes a decision to not give someone the benefit of the doubt. And we see it kind of costs him long term. Let's begin reading in 2 Samuel chapter 10, verse 1. It says, it happened after this that the king of the people of Ammon died, and Hanun his son reigned in his place. Then David, this King David, David said, I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness to me. So David sent by the hand of the servants, the hand of his servants, to comfort him concerning his father. And David's servants came into the land of the people of Ammon. So let's look at that for just a moment. So we don't know a lot about the history here. We know, 40 or 50 years ago, this king who just died, Nahash, he had actually attacked an Israelite city. At that time, Saul had just become the king of Israel. Saul rallied his troops, came and fought back Nahash, all right? So That's all we really know about the history. What we don't know is, what is this he's talking about that Nahash showed kindness to me, right? When David showed you, said, you know, he showed kindness to me, so I'm going to show kindness to him. We don't know what that was. It kind of makes sense to me because Nahash had been an enemy of Saul and David had kind of been an enemy of Saul. So maybe having a common enemy, there was an occasion where they helped each other out. I don't know. But all we know from this so far is, you know what, Nahash had been good to me. I'm going to honor him. And this kind of reminds me of what we do even still today, right? If a foreign dignitary dies, we might send the Secretary of State over. We might send the Vice President over. We might send an entourage of ambassadors over to say, hey, we just want to, you know, tell you how sorry we are about, you know, your father who passed away. And so that's what's happening. So they go there to visit them. Well, let's see what happens. In verse 3 it says, and the princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanan, their lord, this new king, do you think David really honors your father because he has sent comforters to you? Has David not rather sent his servants to you to search the city, to spy it out, and to overthrow it? Right? They're immediately suspicious. They're not here to tell you how sorry they are. They're not here to express sympathy. They're here because they sense a moment of weakness. Man, your father who was king for decades, he has now passed away, and now you're the new guy. They're taking advantage of the situation. They're looking for our weaknesses. They're looking for how they can destroy our city and take over. In verse 4, it says, so Hanan took David's servants, shaved off half their beards, cut off their garments in the middle at their buttocks. Thank you for the clarification. My wife said to me, are you really going to say that in church? I said, well, God did. And then sent them away, right? So they leave humiliated. In verse 5, when they told David, so David gets word of this back in Israel, when they told David, he sent to meet them because the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, wait at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. Jericho would have been the first main Israelite city on the way back in. When the people of Ammon saw that they had made themselves repulsive to David, the word literally means they stunk, right? They were stinky now to David. The people of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians of Beth Rahab and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and from the king of Maacah, 1,000 men, and from Ishtob, 12,000 men. There's a lot, there's a mouthful there, right? Here's the point. The point is, here's Israel. A little over to the east is Ammon, and then Syria has several towns around there. So all it's saying is, Ammon thought, uh-oh, we're in trouble. Let's start getting help from our neighbors. So they paid them a huge sum of money to say, hey, can you guys come help us? Can you come help us? Can you come help us? So he's hiring these kind of mercenary troops. So in verse 7 it says, when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the army of the mighty men. So David sent his commander with his military. Then the people of Ammon came out and put themselves in battle array at the entrance of the gate. So the Ammonites come out of their capital city. They're ready to fight Israel. And the Syrians from these different towns, Zobah and Beth Rahab and Ishtob and Maacah, were by themselves in the field. So when Joab saw the battle line was against him before and behind, he chose some of Israel's best and put them in battle array against the Syrians. And the rest of the people he put under the command of Abishai, his brother, that he might set them in battle array against the people of Ammon. And he said, if the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the people of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will come and help you. So again, on the first read through there, you go, well, what's really happening? Joab shows up with the army of Israel. He shows up with some of his most mighty fighting men to fight Ammon. But when he gets there, he realizes, well, Ammon, the army of Ammon, the Ammonites, they're in front of us. But there's another army behind us. Uh-oh, right? How would you enjoy that battle? Man, we're fighting these guys on this side, but if we turn around, we're fighting these guys on this side. What are we going to do? So they divide the troops. They say, listen, we're going to take some of our best men and go over here and fight the Syrians. You stay over here and fight the Ammonites. And if you get in trouble, we'll come bail you out. If you get in trouble, we'll come bail. Did I say that twice? If I get in trouble, you come bail me out, right? It's a good thing they had clear instructions. All right. He says in verse 12, be of good courage. Let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God, right? They're getting hyped up for battle. And may the Lord do what is good in his sight. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near for the battle against the Syrians. And they fled before him. So they turn around, they're fighting these guys back here, and they start having victory, and the Syrians run off. Now, I think they ran off first because, remember, they were in this for money. They weren't in this for cause. So when they started losing, they're like, we're out of here. And they all took off. So then in verse, continuing in verse 14, it says, when the people of Ammon saw the Syrians were fleeing, they also fled, right? They said, man, we just lost all our paid soldiers. We can't win this thing by ourselves. So they ran away and ran back into the city. So Joab returned from the people of Ammon and went to Jerusalem. So battle's over, everybody goes back home. Verse 15, when the Syrians saw they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered together, right? They said, I can't believe we let them beat us. Let's build up our army more. Let's gather more together. In verse 16, so Hadadezer, who kind of reigned over all this area, Hadadezer sent and brought out the Syrians who were beyond the river. So now not only do they have these Syrians who had been hired before, but he says, let's get some other guys, and they brought them in as well. And they came to Helam, the city of Helam. And Shobak, the commander of Hadadezer's army, went before him. When it was told David, he gathered all Israel. So, I mean, it's just building more and more, right? Syrians get more guys, so Israel's getting more guys. They gather more and more troops. They crossed over the Jordan. They came to Helam, that city where they the Syrians were. And the Syrians set themselves in battle array against David and fought with him. Then the Syrians fled before Israel. Israel won again. Don't mess with Israel. And David killed 700 charioteers and 40,000 horsemen of the Syrians and struck Shobak, the commander of their army, who died there. And when all the kings who were servants to Hadadezer saw they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. And catch this last phrase here. So the Syrians were afraid to help the people of Ammon anymore, right? Next time the people of Ammon call saying, hey, can you help us out? We're going to say, no. Didn't end well for us last time, right? So I want to kind of revisit the story and look at it kind of through the negative lens. Look through it backwards. You know, my dad always told me, is David in here? Whenever David got in trouble, yeah, my dad would sit down with me and he would say, now listen, David's going to make mistakes. Lots and lots. No, I'm just kidding. He said, you know what? When you see David make a mistake and he gets in trouble, you should learn from that and go, I ain't doing that, right? And man, I learned a lot from David's mistakes throughout the years. I just want you to know, I'm just teasing. He's like, that's the last time I come when you're preaching. But I want to look at this story kind of in that light of, this is not a happy story, is it? Man, Hanan made a mistake. It led to another mistake. And pretty soon it turned to long-term consequences for him that were not good. But you know, let's learn from that. Let's look at that and say, you know what? The mistakes he made, let's not make them. Let's not do what he did. He did not give David the benefit of the doubt and ended up costing him in the long run. So I want to talk about that this morning, focusing on Hanan this morning and kind of his decisions. How do we give someone the benefit of the doubt? How do we do that? Well, the number one principle, the number one lesson I think we should learn is, number one, man, let's assume the best. Let's assume the best. The mistake Hanan made here was he assumed the worst. He assumed when he saw David come with his, or David, but when David sent these men and he saw them come in, see, he could have assumed the best. He could have said, man, isn't that nice? Isn't that nice that these guys came here to show me sympathy, to show me compassion, to show me kindness? Man, my dad just passed away. I'm a new king here. But instead, he assumed the worst. Why do we do that? Now, I don't know how many people in here are glass half full people and how many people are glass half empty people. I've been accused at times of being a glass half empty kind of guy. Now, I don't try to be. I did have a recent personality survey. Have you ever had one of these things, like a personality test? Big mistake. Never do that. One of the things it said was, you know, being basically a pessimistic person, you're never surprised by a negative outcome. And this was supposed to be good news to me. That was the positive side. I went, that's the good news? You know, sometimes I think we assume the worst because we've been disappointed before. We've seen bad things before. And so we're just a little bit, we don't want to get our hopes up and think maybe it's good one. Maybe it's really bad. Maybe I should be on my guard. Maybe I should be suspicious. But you know what? It pays to assume the best. I think sometimes we assume the worst because we know ourselves. And sometimes we see things in ourselves and we go, boy, if that was me, I'd probably not have the best motive. If that was me, I think that might be what's happening here. I think as these men saw David's men come into town, they were thinking, if this was us going to visit them, we'd be checking out the city. We'd be looking around going, where are their weaknesses? We'd be looking around saying, man, I bet we could take these guys out. How would we do it? That's what we'd be doing. So they assumed that's what David's men were doing. They're not here to be nice. Who does that? They're here to check us out so they can figure out how to overtake our city, right? I want to do a little test this morning, a little self-test, all right? We got a few questions for you, and I just want you to ask yourself, now, do I tend to assume the best? Do I tend to assume the worst? Or kind of somewhere in the middle, all right? Now, you can kind of test yourself on this, all right? What do you assume when you come home and your kids are watching TV, all right? Do you assume, A, that's where they've been since I left this morning, all right? Do you assume, B, they're probably just resting now from all the housework they've been doing all day? Or do you assume, C, they're watching for commercials to try to decide to buy what to buy me for my birthday? All right, you can just kind of keep track of this on your own, all right? You can see, am I the type of person to assume the best or the worst? Here's the second question. What do you assume when a friend doesn't return your phone call? Do you assume, A, he doesn't like me anymore? Do you assume, B, he got a new phone and can't figure out how to check the messages? I have done that. Do you assume, C, a phone call isn't personal enough? He's driving here to talk to me in person. He loves me. He's my man, my brother. Okay. For the ladies, your husband gives you flowers for no apparent reason. Do you assume, A, he's really messed up this time? Well, I don't know what he's done, but it's something. B, he thinks today might be our anniversary. Or C, he loves me more than life itself. Aww. I think I got one. Did I got one more? Or is that the last one? What do you assume when your coworkers don't come in until noon? Do you assume, A, they went golfing on company time, again? Do you assume, B, they're meeting with an important client? Or C, they've been busy all morning planning my Employee of the Year surprise party? Do you tend to assume the best, or do you tend to assume the worst? You know, I think we need to make an effort to say, I'm going to try to assume the best. I'm going to look at a situation, I'm going to look at somebody's motives, unless I have reason to see, think otherwise, I'm going to assume the best. Let me say as a brief caveat, this doesn't mean turning a blind eye to sin, okay? That's not what I'm talking about. This isn't not calling sin, sin. That's not what I mean. You know, Jesus, when people were snakes, Jesus called them snakes, right? Remember when Paul was talking to the Corinthian church and he kind of got on them because they had let flagrant sin flourish in their church. And he got on them and said, you need to handle that. So I'm not talking about being blind to when sin actually is taking place. But I'm talking about the assumption we make from the beginning. You know, in 1 Corinthians 13, where it describes love, you know, love is patient, love is kind, all those things. One of the things it says that describes love is love believes all things. I read that, I stumble over that. Maybe I'm preaching to me this morning the most of all. Believes all things. It means that, you know what, if we're going to live a life of Christ-like love, we need to choose to have an initial response that says, you know what, I'm going to believe you until you give me reason not to. I'm going to trust your motives until I have reason not to. I'm going to believe the best. I'm going to assume the best. Choosing to assume the best until you have reason not to. All right? So giving people the benefit of the doubt means that first, putting yourself out there a little bit. It's a little bit risky. Assuming the best. The second thing I think we kind of learn from Hannon's story is we need to choose to honor people. We need to make a choice to honor. Even if he was suspicious of these people, notice what he did to them. Now, there are a lot of different, every culture seems to have its own particular things that are offensive. And I just want to apologize up front for putting all these horribly offensive things on the screen here. I feel kind of guilty, you know. I don't want you guys being offended this morning. Did you know that, you know, I think probably one of the most commonly known is up in the left corner there, to show the sole of your shoe. Oh, I'm not going to show you. To show the sole of your shoe to people in the Middle East is very offensive. And even a couple years ago, one time, President Obama was on the phone with Netanyahu. What a great name. Netanyahu. And he was on the phone with him. And while he was on the phone, he let reporters come and take his picture. And his feet were up on his desk. And the Israeli TV newscasters, they thought, oh my goodness, I can't believe he's done this. They found that highly offensive, that while on the phone with him, he would show the sole of his shoe, right? Because to them, that's very offensive. Now, on the bottom here, I remember when we went to the Philippines, and they said, don't do this ever. Really? This means, hey, come here, right? There it means, come here, prostitute, right? That's what it means in the Philippines. And they said that in the missionary work there, they've had people come in. They've had pastors come in and give a great message. And then they say, now come forward for the invitation. Come forward if you'd like to. And they're like, who does he think we are, you know? On the bottom over there, okay. If you ever go to Russia, okay is not okay, okay? And up even on the top, smiling. Now, I don't know. I'm not totally convinced this one is true, but I did read in a couple places that if you're in Korea and you smile at a stranger, it implies you think they're stupid. Very friendly place, Korea, right? I don't know. But in this passage that we just read, you know, guess what in Israel was a very offensive, insulting way to dishonor someone? Shaving their face. Shaving their face was very offensive, right? Isn't he cute? He's adorable. To shave someone's face, to forcibly make someone shave their face was very insulting. Shaving someone's face is what you would do with a slave. Shaving your face is something you would do to somebody that you had conquered. You would make them shave their face. So a beard was a symbol of free man. You know what I mean? When you had a beard, it meant, man, I'm free. And I kind of get that because I shave every day I come to work. But days off, no razor touches this face. Anybody else like that? Vacation, my wife hates it because, man, I just get gross and, you know. Those of you who have beards, great. I can't pull it off. But on vacation, I just get nasty. Beard is free man. So when these guys shaved off their facial hair, it was very humiliating. And then to shave off half of it, I think that's just to make them look ridiculous, right? Just to make them look silly and feel stupid. They did a second thing to them, right? What was that? You guys are nervous about the picture I'm going to put up, aren't you? What's he going to do? Oh. Now, it's a little bit silly looking back on it, but I want you to think for a moment of what that scene was like as they're holding these guys down and shaving their face. And then, you know, they've come. I mean, these aren't soldiers who've been sent in, right? These are guys coming to express condolences. And next thing they know, they're being questioned and they're having their face shaved and they're cutting off their clothes and they're walking around embarrassed trying to cover themselves. And it was probably a party in Hanan's palace that day, right? Making fun and laughing and pointing and and sending them out. And here they're walking out embarrassed, not a friendly face in sight. He chose to dishonor these people. And I think we need to be very careful in our lives to choose whenever we can to honor people. Why do we enjoy when people get dishonored? You walk through the supermarket checkout and you see, man, oh, celebrities with no makeup, right? Wow, look, she gained 50 pounds. Oh, look, who's cheating on who? Look, we like to see people dishonored. Let us be people who choose to honor, to choose to show value for a person. Man, when we embarrass our kids in front of their friends when it's something that could just be handled privately, you know, we need to be careful with that. When we're at a social get-together and we start telling some funny story about something stupid that our wife did, man, we got to be careful with that. That's only funny when you're preaching, right? See, I couldn't tell any embarrassing stories about my wife today because I have this point in my message. Let me show you a few brief passages from the New Testament that talk about honoring people. In Philippians 2, he says, let us each esteem others better than himself. Our goal should be, you know, we talk a lot about self-esteem, right? Do I have high self-esteem? Do I have low self-esteem? You know, the Bible's a lot more concerned about others' esteem, how you think of others, how you look at others. He said, you know what, we should consider others and treat others as if they're better than us. That should be our goal. In Romans 12, he says, be kindly affectionate to one another. Here he's talking about within the church. With brotherly love, in honor, giving preference to one another. We should be honoring each other. Saying, no, let's do it your way, right? That giving preference. In 1 Peter, Peter makes it very simple. Honor all people. And honor everybody, right? We should make the choice to say, you know what? I'm going to choose to honor. But I can't tell you how many times Pastor Mark has said to me in the 10 years we've been working together, something like, Bill, you can never go wrong by choosing to honor somebody. It's never a mistake. You know, a lot of times we've decided, hey, do we want to do this for this person? Do we want to... And often it's just come down to that. You know what? It's never a mistake to honor somebody. Choose to honor people, right? And the last thing I want us to learn from Hannon's story this morning is we need to choose to value the relationship. Value the long-term relationship. Look at what happened in the story that didn't have to happen. And imagine what it could have been like. Imagine what could have happened if he would have assumed the best instead of the worst. And if he would have honored these men instead of dishonoring them. Man, he would have been good friends now with David, who turns out to be one of the most powerful men in the world. He would have had a friendship instead of enmity between them. He would have had a great alliance with a kingdom that was right next to where he was. It could have been great. But instead, they've become enemies. Nations now have gone to war against each other. Thousands of Syrians died in this, you know, second battle. And we didn't even, you know, in chapter 11 is where then they go after the Ammonites again. So we didn't even get to that. But my point is, to make these poor choices in maybe a day, maybe a week, we don't know how long this period of time was, but because of the decisions he made there to assume the worst and to dishonor, it cost him long-term great relationship. And I think what we need to learn from that is, I think sometimes we value this moment's controversy more than we value the long-term relationship. If I'm getting into it with something about my wife, I care more about winning this argument right now than I care about, man, I want to have a great marriage in 5 years and in 10 years and in 20 years. We get caught up in a moment and make decisions right now that hurt the long-term relationship. We need to train ourselves to think, you know what, what's really important here is the relationship. Even with my kids, man, my girls, I've got four good girls, man, good-hearted. But they are learning, I think, what all of us learn, which is sometimes it's harder to get along with the person that you're closest to more than just about anybody else, right? I mean, the person you share a bedroom with can be the hardest person to get along with. You can be nicer to the person at Casey's. You can get along great with people at work. But the people you got to live with and make decisions with and spend money with. And I think, you know, my girls now are 13 and 11 and 8 and 6. And man, I tell you what, as a dad, sometimes it breaks my heart when I see the way they talk to each other. Man, they'll say things that are just so biting, and I go, oh, man. And I'm thinking, they'd never talk to their friends that way. They'd never talk to anybody at church that way. But man, they'll say, man, they just know how to shoot that dagger, and they know how to get each other. And it breaks my heart as a dad. You know, I sit there, I go, oh. And I've sat down with them, I've tried to explain to them. See, you know, as an old 40-year-old man, I can see things different than what they can, right? Because I look at it and I see, you know what, in 20 years and in 30 years, that girl is going to be one of your best friends in the world. She's going to be the one that you call on the phone and want to talk to. She's going to, when you've forgotten most of the names of every other friend you have right now, that sister who doesn't want to watch the same TV show that you want to watch, who borrows your stuff without asking, who won't leave you alone when you have a friend over and just want to play with them, she's going to be the one that you have a long-term relationship with that hopefully will be priceless. Do you really want to do things, say things, that someday you're going to go, man, I wish I never would have said that to her? And you know what? It's not just kids. Man, it's spouses. It's friends. Do we really want to say those things, and do we really want to do those things that could hurt what could otherwise be a great long-term friendship, long-term relationship? Let's choose to value the relationship that we have more than the petty difference that we're upset about at the moment, right? Value the relationship. I feel like I've just preached a very simple message. I feel like I'm just saying, hey, be nice to people, right? But I think, man, let's learn from these things. Assume the best about people. Choose to honor people whenever it's possible. Honor. And care more about the relationship than just about what's happening right now. All right? Let's bow our heads for just a moment.